This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 1839, Bennington cabinetmaker Hastings Kendrick placed an ad in the Vermont Gazette. His tagline in the ad, rich and tasty furniture. The Shelburne Museum has used that phrase for their new blockbuster exhibition, Rich and Tasty, Vermont Furniture to 1850. It looks back at the big and varied world of Vermont furniture, and a lot of it is more elaborate than you might think. Think ornamentation, multiple native woods, and intricate carvings. Think more Fifth Avenue apartment than Shaker Village. And many of the pieces in this show have never been publicly exhibited before. It's a window into a mostly forgotten but booming era of craftsmanship and artistry in the state. Here to talk about the exhibit and the history of Vermont furniture making is Jean Burks, Shelburne Museum's curator emerita. She put together Rich and Tasty, and it's her last big exhibit at the museum before she retires. She also co-authored the catalog for the show, which is an art object all by itself. Jean Burks, welcome to Vermont Edition. Nice to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we just dispatch with this early on? Because every time I say rich and tasty, it makes me feel squirmish. What does that actually mean, and why is it something that actually illuminates something about the Vermont furniture world?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to realize that it's a shortcut for rich and tasteful, just as you would say something is delish instead of delicious. So I think it does capture the spirit of Vermont furniture, which visually is spectacular, but I think it also makes you smile. You look at it and you're surprised. You admire the craftsmanship, but you also admire the ingenuity of the makers who have come up with a very unique interpretation of various furniture forms.
And that shortening of tasteful to tasty was part of the vernacular in the 1850s?
That was the media speak, and they used it not only for furniture, but if you read advertisements, you'll see notices for rich and tasty patterns, fabric patterns imported from England. Steamships going up the Hudson would advertise rich and tasty interiors. So rich and tasty was everywhere.
And now here it is at the Shelburne Museum in this big, bold, new exhibit about Vermont furniture. And as we mentioned, this is Vermont furniture to 1850. Why to 1850? What was particularly exciting about the early 1800s and perhaps even late 1700s?
You see a very strong craft tradition of handmade pieces from 1800 to about 1850. And then you start to get into more mechanized, more mass production kinds of furniture. So we wanted to really focus in on the individual cabinet makers, very well documented pieces, and unusual forms.
So tell us a couple of things you have on exhibit.
Well, we have everything from furniture from the Northeast Kingdom, from Franklin County to Bennington County. We've looked at furniture from specific towns, such as Burlington, Milton, and Woodstock, as well as Middlebury. And then we focused on different forms, things such as the very native Vermont form called the locker or sideboard, which is only made here in Vermont, to card tables, stands, bureaus, and painted furniture. So we sort of covered regional characteristics as well as unique forms.
Let's talk about that locker or the side table. Why is that unique to Vermont? And describe what it was for people who are certainly not picturing the right kind of locker.
It is advertised often as a locker, and it is a very small sideboard, but it's fitted with what we call bottle drawers. So there are these long, deep drawers that pull out on either side where you can store your liquor. And it's a very small form. It's much more diminutive than if you think of a Hepplewhite sideboard that is sort of a massive piece. This is very much smaller, and it only seems to be made in Vermont.
If you spread out your hands, how wide would it be?
I would say about the width of your arms, perhaps, and maybe a little bit less.
So still pretty large, though. I mean, smaller than a big sideboard,
right.
but this is not a tiny piece of furniture.
No, this would be a dining room parlor piece that you would have in your house.
Why was it only made here, do you think?
That's a good question. And I'm not exactly sure why. I don't think it has to do with the size of the houses. I honestly don't know why, but it seems to be only Vermont based on the signed examples that we have.
When we talked earlier, just at the very beginning of the show, about this new exhibit and Vermont furniture and invited people to think of it as splashier than they might have imagined, or not just sort of Shaker-inspired farmhouse furniture, utilitarian, Do you think that does surprise people to think about Vermont furniture as much more ornate and intricate and exciting?
I think it does. The journey to this exhibition started 20 years ago in 1995, when I literally was my first day here at Shelburne Museum as curator of decorative arts. And we received the exhibit put on by the Bennington Museum called The Best the Country Affords, which was the first look at Vermont furniture that anyone had ever done. And that furniture traveled from Bennington to Shelburne, and I was the receiving curator. And I was flabbergasted by this furniture. It's funny you should mention Shaker, because that's an area that I'm very familiar with, and I've written a number of books on Shaker. And this is so far removed. I expected more sort of country-painted furniture, more Shaker in spirit. And what arrived were these amazing forms, very high-style forms made with beautiful woods, local woods, as opposed to imported woods like mahogany, but the richness of the grains and the combination of materials. Clearly, these cabinet makers were familiar with furniture made in high-style centers like Boston and New York and Portsmouth, but they've interpreted it in their own way. And ever since then, I've been on the lookout for more documented Vermont furniture because people were fascinated by it and started to collect it very quietly, private collectors. And sure enough, 20 years later, I was able to locate this great stash of pieces that very knowledgeable people had put together and had never shown to the public before.
When we talk about this furniture, though, are we assuming a certain class level of the people who owned it, that there you had to have enough money to have this kind of furniture? This was not what was seen in every Vermont farmhouse and every house in every village, or was it?
Well, that's an interesting question, because these cabinet makers were advertising, and there were many, many of them listed in city directories and advertisements, who were advertising very high-end furniture forms, claw-footed tables, swell front bureaus. And that clearly was designed for a deep pocketbook. However, when you read some accounts, and I wrote about it in my essay in the catalog, when you read some accounts of local people who were farmers and were building furniture for their family, they have diaries, and they're talking about making this amazing furniture out of the local woods that they have and selecting specifically bird's eye maple for this part and tiger maple for that part. And these were gifts and wedding presents for daughters. So I think this aesthetic was one that was marketed to people who could afford it, as well as something aspired to by local makers.
Today we're learning about Vermont furniture. You may have some in your own home. You may have pieces that have been handed down or replicas. If you stop at some of the state's official rest areas along the interstates, you might take a break in a Vermont folk rocker. In a few minutes, we're going to talk more about contemporary movements and styles like that. But right now, we're diving into the history of woodworking in the state and learning that while you might suspect a staid, quiet, utilitarian style to be the norm, Vermont woodworkers in the 18th and 19th centuries were creative and expressive. Jean Burks, who's curated an exhibit that just opened at Shelburne Museum called Rich and Tasty Vermont Furniture to 1850, is sharing her knowledge and expertise, and we'd love to know what questions you have. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. It turns out, Jean Burks, there were a lot of furniture makers in Vermont. You express, not surprise exactly, but amazement at how many, I mean, hundreds of furniture makers in this period that you have on display at the museum. Why so many?
When you think of Vermont being settled, people were moving up here from Connecticut, from Boston, from urban areas, and they had taste and they had expectations as to what they expected. And in fact, one of the exciting things about the book is the section on Woodstock. And Woodstock really had the second largest number of cabinet makers in the state, second only to Burlington. And we were able to piece together furniture that had been in three very distinguished families in Woodstock, the Dana families, the Swan family, and two members of the Dana family and the Swan family, who lived on Elm Street and built very, very extravagant houses. They came here from out of state. They established businesses, dry goods stores, and they wanted nice furniture. And they acquired furniture built by local Woodstock craftsmen that stayed in those families for generations, and only maybe in the last 100 years were separated. And the exciting thing is, with this exhibit, we were able to reunite this furniture that had been in these three houses and were attributed either by written history, oral history, signatures on the pieces. Everything was really well documented. And so now we really get a feel for what kind of great stuff was in these houses.
So is that kind of furniture that you're talking about something that's been preserved over time and really looked at as almost an art piece rather than a piece of furniture that families are using through the generations?
Well, it's interesting. These were all used. We know that, you know, this kettle stand sat next to the sofa in the parlor. So they were using this furniture. And I think that's an interesting thing about Vermont furniture, that it was used. And even the collectors today, this small group of private collectors, and there's only about four of them who contributed to this show. So much of this furniture came out of private homes. These people used their furniture. It is throughout their houses. One lender was saying, well, I need to find some place to put my socks because you have my bureau.
Yes, but nobody putting down, a nice cold glass of water in the summertime that's sweating onto that wood, or, you know, having their kids run by with a crayon and writing on it. These are pretty well preserved.
Yes, they're in very, very good shape.
I'm curious about one particular style that flipping through your book, Rich and Tasty, Vermont Furniture to 1850, which is the catalog for the exhibit, cropped up a few times and is familiar to me from looking at furniture in people's houses over the years. And this is frequently chairs, sometimes rocking chairs, often those sort of wide seat chairs that are painted black. And then they often have gold paint, either sort of lining the chairs, or there are often gold paint along the back of the chair that's in sort of leaf motif or grapes. There seems to be a couple of examples of mm-hmm. that in your catalog. So what was that style?
We did include painted furniture. And the reason we included some of the pieces is that they were hand done. They were hand painted, hand gilded, as opposed to, as you move along in time, these pieces tend to be more mass produced. And we did want to show that the early examples, and we have some signed ones that are documented, were indeed made with a little more personal attention than as if they were mass-produced.
If you have a question for Jean Berks about Vermont furniture and Vermont's furniture history, call 1-800-639-2211. If you are a local furniture maker yourself, you could share a picture with us. Go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Show us your work. Tell us a little bit about what you see as your style. Let's go to Chris, who's calling in from Hinesburg. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi there. Thank you for taking my call. And I just did want to give a quick shout-out to the exhibit, which I visited on Sunday with some friends. It's excellent, so much better than I would have expected. The furniture, the quality is just amazing, and the displays are wonderful. So I would encourage anyone to go. But my question that I had is there was a set of beautiful matching card tables, and I'm wondering – and the card on the exhibit said it's very rare to find two in that kind of condition still together. Why two? Was it a particular card game or some kind of parlor game where you would need to have, you know, sort of opposing teams? That's my question.
That's a good question. Card tables were often made in pairs, and I think part of it had to do with the fact that if you could afford one of these and you were entertaining and having, you know, games, you really should have two. Unfortunately, they tend to get split up over time. And what's so fabulous about those tables, if they were not, one of them is signed by the maker who's identified, and the collector acquired that piece many years ago. And he has a terrific eye. And more recently, he found the matching pair in a totally different place, unmarked, and reunited the tables together. So this is one of the very few pairs of card tables that actually do survive.
Can you tell us another favorite piece of yours?
I will make no bones about it. My piece that really I think is spectacular is the James Richardson work table, which is, it is over the top. It is a little work table. It doesn't have a straight line on it. The back splashboard scrolls all over the place. The front is serpentine. The legs are turned, and the feet look like they came out of, if you know Tonet Bentwood furniture, it looks like this is a precursor to that.
I don't know that furniture.
It's all the Bentwood rockers. So that's the kind of legs that this thing has. And the woods are all figured woods from Vermont as well as some imported mahogany. And it is just spectacular. And I have to say, one of the exciting things about doing a show like this, this is the only known signed piece by James Richardson from Pulteney. We knew he existed in the Cabinet Makers Directory, but we'd never seen a piece. So this is very exciting. So shortly after the catalog came out, or actually shortly after one of the newspaper, Newtown Bee, put out a cover story about the show, I get an email from a gentleman who says, I can't believe this. He said, I've been looking for James Richardson forever. He said, I have a sideboard signed exactly the same way, James Richardson Pulteney, and here's a picture of it. And it is spectacular. So I've now started another notebook for another Vermont furniture show with other pieces that come up in the future.
Yes, but Jean, this is sort of your swan song at the museum. You said that your first day was this exhibit that came to you, your first day as curator. This is your last. You're on your way out. You're an officially curator emerita now. So you don't have another 20 years probably that you're going to do this again unless you want to crop up out of retirement.
Well, I feel that when you're really wedded to a subject, you need to continue that documentation. So I figure I'll keep my notebook and, you know, pass it on to whoever's interested or to the Shelburne Museum, but at least the documentation will be there.
Why is this so interesting to you, though? Because I can imagine people saying, really, you're going to have like a blockbuster exhibit on furniture and a book, and then VPR is doing a show on this? I mean, furniture's boring. You'd sit in it. You use it for a bed. It's utilitarian. Why do we care what it looked like in 1850?
Well, it's funny. Over the years, there's been a great emphasis on regional furniture studies. There's been studies of Connecticut furniture, books published. Massachusetts furniture last year was a major study, and furniture shown at different institutions in Massachusetts. Portsmouth's furniture, Salem, Massachusetts furniture. So this follows in a tradition of let's dig into the furniture of our area, of our state, and let's get it documented. So we're really sort of part of that bandwagon, and no one had really ever done such an extensive study of Vermont furniture. So this was the reason for the show.
Does it go beyond just documenting for you? Do you think it illuminates anything about our culture and our history?
I think what's interesting about it is the use in Vermont in particular of the native woods. When you see, this is high-style furniture. This is not, I mean, these are, as I said, clawfoot tables and card tables and things you'd find in Boston. But instead of relying on imported woods, mahogany, these cabinet makers have taken our local bounty, have taken local cherry and yellow birch and bird's eye maple and tiger maple and created this vibrant surface out of what's here. And I find that really interesting. And one of the things we did in the show, we have what I call the wall of woods. So we have actually taken planks of all these different primary woods and some of the secondary woods, because it's interesting what secondary woods were used here in Vermont. We didn't use poplar. It was mostly basswood and pine for secondary woods and butternut. And people can actually touch this wood, and you can really feel the grain. When you feel it, you sort of get a real connection to what these woodworkers were working with.
We're looking at the rich history of Vermont furniture and woodworking today. Coming up, we're going to move ahead in time and take a look at some of the contemporary trends. And we'd love to hear from woodworkers listening in. Tell us what you specialize in and if you think there's a cohesive style to Vermont furniture today. Do you look back at the old styles of furniture and gain inspiration from them for your work today? And where do you see the market? Are people buying handmade pieces anymore? Or are you losing out to the IKEAs of the world? Let us know. You can write to us, send a note to vermontedition@vpr.net, or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We've been learning about the elaborate artistry behind Vermont's woodworking and furniture history with Jean Burks, whose final show as curator at the Shelburne Museum is called Rich and Tasty, Vermont Furniture to 1850. So what happened after 1850? David Hurwitz was named Vermont Woodworker of the Year in 2014, and he's on the board of the Vermont Wood Manufacturers Association. He's going to help bring us up to the modern day. David, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on. And also wanted to just thank Jean for the work she's done in organizing this show. I haven't actually seen the show yet, but I'm definitely planning to get up there and see it, and I'm really excited to see it.
Well, and we will say that the exhibit just opened on July 25th, and it'll run until November 1st, so people have some time to see this. David, you've been listening to this conversation. Do you see references to the themes that we've been talking about historically in Vermont woodworking today, either in your work or others?
Yes, definitely. And one thing is what's great to hear about this show is the fact that it highlights the sort of wide variety of styles that were done way back then, and then the kind of high style and the use of different native woods. That continues today, and there's a wide range of styles that furniture makers are producing today. There's still an emphasis on unique pieces, custom pieces, handwork, and then more and more today there's an emphasis on using local woods and especially sustainably harvested woods as well.
How would you describe your style?
My style is, I would best describe it as contemporary. I design and build, so I don't do reproductions. I don't build other pieces, you know, other designs by other people. But it's also it tends to be very sculptural. I use a lot of carving in my work. And then I kind of explore different textures, different surface treatments, sometimes color, sometimes paint, sometimes different materials as well besides wood.
Jean Burks, do you look at furniture coming out of Vermont today from small manufacturers or individuals and see this same kind of tie-in to the past that David's talking about?
I do, and I think what David just said, the idea of the surface and the textures, I see that that's exactly what the 19th century cabinet makers were doing, was to, you know, to combine all of that. So I see that as a continuing tradition.
We got a note from Timothy who says, it's great that this show is happening at Shelburne Museum, and it's good to see that you have Dave Hurwitz on the show. Hi, Dave. I am very proud to be a member of the Guild of Vermont Furniture Makers, who are a group of the modern master furniture makers in the state. The museum is a great place, and I am happy to have had the opportunity to make stainless steel and cherry benches for the new Pizzagalli Art Center and a reproduction of the web dresser break front that is in the brick house. That's Timothy Clark, and I'm
yes.
seeing a nod
yeah.
of recognition right. from Eugene.
Good to hear from him.
And let's go to Ellen, who's calling in from St. Albans. Hi, Ellen. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
My family has a tall clock, and it was made in Connecticut and brought with the family moving to Vermont. Visiting another house in Franklin County, I saw the same tall case and realized that they must have brought only the clockworks up from Connecticut and had a joiner make the tall cases up here. So,
Ellen, what does it look like?
That's the point I wanted to make.
Well, can you describe what
I'm
it
sorry?
Looks like? Can you describe what it looks like?
The tall case clock is a cherry. It's a cherry clock, very simple, but has a scroll work around the top. So nothing too fancy.
Ellen, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Gina, does that sound like something that would have happened?
Yes, that's very interesting because we have a very important tall case clock in the show, and it was made, the works were made by a Connecticut, of course, all the clock, many of the clock makers' works came from Connecticut. Asa Hill Cheney came to South Royalton, and he became very friendly with John Marshall, who was a cabinet maker, and they collaborated on clocks, and we have one of those collaborated clocks in our collection. So it makes perfect sense just what was said.
We got a note from Jeff Weinstein who posted a photo for us, and he says, here's a shout out to the fine craftsfolk around the state who have exceptional talent but don't necessarily sell their wares commercially. And he says, here's a table made for us by Daniel Wetmore. All wood is local and processed in Dan's workshop. He says that's Dan showcasing his finished work because Dan is lying prone across the tabletop. So we'll try to post this on our Facebook page or on our website. Thank you for that, Jeff. David Horwitz, I'm wondering from you if you see other craftsmen like that who are maybe not selling at a scale where they can make a living, but are starting to create a name for themselves in the state from people who really appreciate this kind of craftsmanship.
Yeah, that's definitely going on out there. There's a range of folks. Some people are maybe just getting started, or they're juggling it part time with other jobs. But what I do see is that it's easier today to make a go of it now, because the market has changed with the advent of the internet. And so, in the Guild of Vermont Furniture Makers, for example, we're a group of 31 professional makers who have come together to do collective marketing together and also to do shows together. We have a website that we share. It's VermontFurnitureMakers.com. And so that's kind of opened up a lot of new avenues for people to make it a more viable way to do this for a living, to do it full time.
So it doesn't feel like a competitive group. You feel like you're collaborators or at least supporters of one another?
You know, it doesn't, and that's one of the really amazing things about the group, and also just kind of being a woodworker in Vermont, is there's really no, like, competitive vibe that I've ever picked up in the time that I've been doing it in this state. And there's just, you know, it's quite the opposite. There's just a real level of camaraderie and sharing of ideas, and so that's been really, really wonderful.
Gene, have you seen any references in old documents to whether or not that might have been the same or a different feel in the 1800s? Because as we mentioned before, there were hundreds of people making furniture and trying to sell it. So do you think it would have been more competitive than today?
I do, actually. I think it would have been. You often see cabinet makers in the same town advertising for their own apprentices, although you also do see documentation, particularly in Woodstock, with one cabinet making group coming in and taking over somebody else's shop who's moved on or moved elsewhere. But I think when you read these ads, these guys are very much trying to push their line, Rich and Tasty, and particular pieces that they made. So I think it was pretty competitive.
David Horwitz, you just mentioned that you think it's easier now with the advent of the internet for woodworkers in Vermont to make a living. But we've also seen, you know, again, with the advent of the internet, the ability for people to buy things online cheaply that are made abroad. You find that you can actually make a living doing this, and you're not outsold by people who say, you know, I don't need to spend the money to get a fine piece of furniture. I can just replace the cheap one that I get every couple of years.
Yeah, well, I guess the thing about it is it's a couple of things. I guess what the web has done is it's opened up, it's made it possible for us to access a more national and, with some people, actually an international market, whereas before our ability to sell was really as far as we were willing to travel to a show or our willingness to maybe spend money on print advertising. So there's that part of it. But yeah, as far as competition with cheaper goods, I think that really the challenge for us is to really educate the customers about the difference, about what sets it apart. That when you buy handmade work or work that's built here, it's built to a higher standard of quality. That we're kind of like the craftsmen of old. We're building with the intention that this is something that's going to last, that it'll hopefully be an heirloom piece, that it'll be passed on through generations. And so that comes down to quality construction, quality joinery, selection of materials. There's all these different attention to details that are oftentimes lacking in some of the cheaper mass-produced stuff.
I imagine beauty, too. I mean, people want to look at something that's beautiful and keep it around with them.
Yep. And then there's also this aspect, too, of buying local. You're supporting a local economy, and then there's this whole aspect of the working lands, and that's one thing I've been involved with the Vermont Wood Manufacturers Association, is the concept is that if you're buying things that are produced locally, you're not just supporting a local furniture maker, you're also in turn supporting the local forest landowner, the local logger, the local sawmill, the local wood dealer. It's that whole supply chain, and that's part of a really critical part of the Vermont economy. Similar with with ag and food, they're doing the same thing with farm to table.
Let's go to Beth, who's calling in from Rutland. Hey, Beth, you're on the line.
Hey, good morning. This is your silly phone call, but it's in a way it's not too silly. I clean houses part-time for a living, and I've got to tell you, I love, you know, some ornate pieces of furniture, but I'd like to just tell furniture makers who are working today, you've got to think about people who have to clean and dust that furniture, because truthfully, it can turn into a real project. So anyways, that's your silly phone call.
Well, Beth, not so silly, really. I mean, you do think about these are pieces that people are using in their homes, and furniture is meant to be used. It's not meant just to be hung on the wall. So certainly think about the end user and the end cleaner. I appreciate that call. And I really appreciated this conversation, opening our eyes to the history of Vermont furniture and a little bit into what contemporary furniture and woodworking is like today. Jean Burks is curator emerita of the Shelburne Museum. She's curator of the museum's Rich and Tasty Vermont Furniture to 1850 exhibit. It's her final show at the museum, and it's open until November 1st. Jean, what a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Hurwitz is an award-winning Randolph woodworker and furniture maker. He was Vermont Woodworker of the Year in 2014, and he will be curating an exhibit of his own. It's called Joined, Inspired Approaches to Vermont Contemporary Furniture and Wood Design, and that's at the Frischgott Sordiff Gallery in Shelburne. It runs September 4th to October 21st. David, a pleasure to have you on the show as well.
Thank you so much, Jane. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, a local company is hoping its role in making a new Tesla battery pack for commercial and industrial spaces will help sustain its growth here in Vermont. And later, we'll hear music from the Aerolites on Live from the Fort. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's been a lot of buzz about a battery system from Tesla that will allow homeowners to store energy that they're producing from intermittent sources like solar and use that energy later when their power needs rise or when the sun isn't shining. There's also a big brother to this Powerwall battery system. It's called the PowerPack, and it's for large-scale commercial and industrial customers. And a Vermont corporation is playing a role in bringing that to market. The Dynapower Company, based in South Burlington, is making energy storage inverters for the PowerPack. Chip Palombini, the sales manager of energy storage systems at Dynapower Company, told us why people are so jazzed about this Tesla development.
People are really excited about them because of the price point that Tesla is able to offer them at. So it enables additional deployments and use cases that with the pre-existing economic structures of batteries were not able to be realized.
So what is it exactly that Dynapower is contributing to the PowerPack?
Yeah, so specifically, Dynapower is delivering inverters to Tesla for use with the PowerPack. So the inverter is what connects the battery to the utility grid and really lets the battery charge and discharge from the grid and be utilized by the utility or the end customer for all the benefits of the energy storage system.
Go ahead and get us a little deeper here for people who want to hear all the specifics and explain how these energy storage systems work. I mean, break down the components from the battery to the inverter to the main energy grid and how that all works.
Sure. So most energy storage systems are grid tied. So they're designed to interact with an existing utility grid. In Vermont, for example, connected to Green Mountain Power or Burlington Electric. The battery itself is the primary component. That's where the energy is really stored. And the inverter, which is what Dynapower supplies, is what enables the battery to interact with the grid. Now, on top of that is a software controller that determines when we charge and discharge the battery. So taking it just a step further, the battery is DC, so direct current, while the utility grid is an AC sine wave. And what the Dynapower inverter does is converts the AC to DC when we need to charge the battery, and then converts the DC energy of the battery to AC power when we need to discharge the battery.
So if somebody wasn't going to be connected to the grid, they don't technically need the inverter.
They would still need the inverter. So most appliances and you know, loads in a household are AC. They're designed for 120 volts, or in industrial facilities, they're three-phase loads. So you still need the inverter to convert the battery from DC to AC.
Got
to
it.
Make it a usable form of energy. And the inverters we are supplying to Tesla for the power pack do enable off-grid applications.
You mentioned, Chip, that the power pack is the big brother to the power wall that's for more residential use. So who's actually buying these energy storage systems?
Yeah, that's a good question. The end users are varied, both domestically and globally. So we'll be providing inverters to Tesla for their deployments not only in North America, but also in Europe and Australia. The users change a little bit based upon geography, but if we think about North America, it'll be large industrial facilities, manufacturers like Dynapower, for example, and some of the big box stores like Target, Walmart, Kohl's, as well as utilities like Green Mountain Power.
So is Dynapower actually going to be using these Tesla power packs that you're helping to create?
We hope so. We have a large energy storage system at our facility in South Burlington that's coupled with what's become the iconic wind turbine that we have here, and we do have solar as well, so we do have hopes of adding a Tesla battery to the two existing batteries that we have on site already.
I assume you'd get some kind of special, you know, like staff privilege or something like that.
One can hope, but we shall see.
How did this collaboration or this contract come to be between Tesla and Dynapower?
That's a great question. So Dynapower really prides itself on the quality of our product and the experience we provide to our customers. So we really have a referral and a pre-existing customer to thank for this. So we had an engineer working for another customer, moved over to work with Tesla, and when Tesla needed inverters, they had such a phenomenal previous experience with Dynapower at their previous employer that they strongly encouraged Tesla to get in touch with us. And once Tesla was in touch with Dynapower, we were able to deliver them with a superior product and amazing experience, and that's really what's led to the success of this deal.
How big a deal is it? Can you tell me the financials?
We cannot share the financials, unfortunately.
Can you tell me how important having a contract like this is to the sustainability of Dynapower?
So it certainly accelerates our growth. So the Tesla contract is a significant contract for Dynapower, and helps us make additional investments into the growth of our business for years to come in the future.
You mentioned a little bit earlier why people have been buzzing about the Tesla power pack and the power wall. Can you explain a little bit why this is exciting to people who are interested in the renewable energy sector in particular?
So in islanded communities, for example, Hawaii and the Caribbean, where most of their energy is being generated by fossil fuels, so then the energy prices are directly proportional, of course, to the fossil fuel prices, there's been a large push for very high penetration of renewable energy, primarily being wind and solar, to offset the fossil fuel-based generation, of course, for environmental improvements as well as cost improvements. Once you get to a higher penetration of renewables, there can be stability problems on the grid because for solar, you're limited by clouds, and wind, of course, you're limited by wind gusts and lulls in the wind. So the battery systems enable a higher penetration of renewable energy assets than you would be able to realize without the batteries, because the batteries can now smooth the intermittency of the wind or solar power. So in islanded communities, it's enabling them to further reduce their ability to rely on fossil fuel-based generation.
So one of the issues has always been, as you brought up, that reliability, or, you know, as some people talk about it, the need for baseline power, and whether or not renewable sources like solar and wind can provide that baseline power because they are intermittent sources. So if I'm hearing what you're saying right, these battery packs, that they're storage, right? They allow you to store some of that energy, so it's less important whether the sun is shining at the moment you need that power because you have it basically stored up. Is that sort of the common person way of thinking about it?
Yeah, exactly. So it makes, in the technical terms, we would consider wind and solar non-dispatchable assets. So a fossil fuel-based generator, we can put more fuel in and say, give me power, and it's going to give us power as long as there's fuel. Wind and solar, we're really limited by nature. So by coupling batteries with the wind or solar asset, it enables you to make it more of a firmed or dispatchable asset.
Chip, I understand that, leaving aside this Tesla connection that we've been talking about, Dynapower is working with Vermont communities to really improve their off-grid energy storage. Can you explain what projects you're working on?
Yeah, so we submitted a grant application to DOE for a project that we're doing now with Green Mountain Power in Rutland, behind the Rutland High School there. It's called the Stafford Hill Project. So that will be actually the nation's largest solar plus energy storage microgrid. So the system will be able to provide solar power to the grid in the form of solar generation, and will also be able to provide backup power in the event of a utility outage to the high school for it to act as an emergency shelter. So that's one way we're working to improve the energy infrastructure and resiliency of the grid for critical infrastructure pieces like an emergency shelter.
That's Chip Palombini. He's sales manager of the Energy Storage Group at Dynapower in South Burlington. Chip, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And we finish today with the music of the Aerolites from VPR's Live from the Fort series. The Aerolites are a five-piece rock Americana jam band fronted by Jeremy Harple and Victor Veve. This is Rust Today.
Typewriter's working, the bills always fine, but before my paycheck I'll be searching. Now I wait for the man to come knocking at my door, dug a hole in my backyard, I'm not sure I can grow the cure. Oh, oh, got a head full of ideas and science, knows no answer, all these can't find it. Oh, oh, got a eye in the dark to keep from.
That's Rust Away from the band The Aerolites. It was recorded in the VPR Performance Studio as part of our Live from the Fort series. If you're in a band or know a great band who you think we should consider for the series, you can email us. Write to livefromthefort@vpr.net. Tomorrow on the program, a wildlife story that has sparked a global reaction. The killing of Cecil the lion by an American big game hunter in Zimbabwe has enraged many people who've gone on social media to talk about it. And it raises questions about the legal protections and social norms around hunting and poaching wild animals. Our guest tomorrow will be Laurel Nimi of Shelburne, who's researched and written extensively about international wildlife tracking, or trafficking, and efforts to prevent and solve crimes against protected animals. Join us for that discussion tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.